Edvinka is an investment company exclusively dedicated to education. Edvinka is the fruit of a joint venture between Hamburg Perks, the growth investment firm behind PyTop and Cortex, and DLF Venture, a family-owned holding company affiliated to Verdinvest, who have invested in some of the most successful edtech companies in Asia, like Baijus. At Edvinka, our aim is to help edtech startups make large-scale impact. We are active investors who like to think global. We invest in early-stage companies that we grow alongside their founders. We offer follow-on funding and deploy permanent capital to address our long-term vision. Please visit our website on www.edvinka.com to find out more about our mission and get in touch on info@edvinka.com if you want to discuss your edtech business with us.
Here's a word from Class Central, the most popular search and review site for online courses. If you've ever gone on the hunt for a great online course from a top university, then you may already know about Class Central. Class Central is the most comprehensive search engine for MOOCs and online courses. The site lists over 10,000 courses and allows you to search by subject, university, keyword, and language of instruction. With tens of thousands of user reviews, you can use Class Central to help you decide if a course is right for you. And if you're into geeking out about online learning like I am, you'll love diving into Class Central's MOOC report. The MOOC report covers everything that's going on in the MOOC space, with news, analysis, and opinions about the fascinating world of online courses. A great place to start is with Class Central's in-depth analysis of the state of MOOCs in 2017. You can find a link in our show notes. Or if you're interested in finding out which courses are ranked the highest, check out Class Central's course rankings for the month and the year, or have a look at the top 50 MOOCs of all time. Hello everyone, how's it going? Welcome back, or if you're new, hello and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. What's going on this week? Well, the EdTech Podcast celebrated its second birthday, and London listeners came along to our meetup on hiring and retaining talent, including advisory networks. Thanks to Jamie Brooker, Christine Weatherby and Will Bentick for speaking and sharing their learnings. It was a great night at Runway East. I've also been busy squirreling away on the EdTech Podcast Festival, and all the pieces are slowly coming together. I'm delighted that Anton Fransik, Principal Secondary Advisor at Hackney Learning Trust, will be joining the event. I'm also working on bringing some of the international community along, plus putting on clinics on how to work with researchers and journalists on evidence-based news stories. But what about this week's podcast, I hear you cry? Well, this week I'm in conversation with EDX CEO Anant Agrawal. I interviewed Anant the day after he shared a stage with US Ed Secretary Betsy DeVos, where he encouraged her to consider a range of policy options in front of a live audience at South by Southwest EDU in Austin. In this recording, we talk about that experience, plus how MOOCs and online learning are developing, and we even invite Class Central founder Dawal Shah to bring his expertise to bear after his fantastic talk on MOOCs also at South By. Thanks to Edvinka and Class Central for supporting this week's episode. Now I'm off to go and watch my big brother get married. Have a great week! Yay! I'm absolutely delighted to be here with Anant Agrawal, CEO of edX. So welcome.
Oh, thank you. Delighted to join you.
So I was really thrilled yesterday to watch the presentation from the Secretaries for Education and then the panel that followed. And it seemed that what you were saying had a fairly positive response from people in the audience. So can you tell us a little bit just to kick off? Because I think it was very memorable for me coming from the UK and watching quite a bizarre setup of the Secretaries for Education interviewing three edtech companies, essentially. How that went. So what was the experience like for you?
It was, in education we talk about flipped classrooms. And to me this was a flipped panel in the sense that usually you would have reporters and people like ourselves shooting questions at the Secretary of Education. And here the roles were reversed and she was challenging us and shooting questions at us. So it was a very interesting style of meeting. I certainly enjoyed it. I thought that the questions were right on, particularly about what are the kinds of transformations we need to be creating, what are the kinds of innovations we need to be creating in education. And she challenged us to come up with what might be the big innovative approaches. And I talked about how we need to reimagine education from the ground up. Our education system was built hundreds of years ago, mm-hmm. and simply doesn't match today's needs. So today, our education system needs to become modular. Rather than have people go to college for 4 years when they start out and then go to work and not learn thereafter, is not a model that works anymore. In a society where things are changing so fast, where things like data science, where all the jobs are, that phrase wasn't coined 10 years ago. And so our education system needs to become modular and more agile and lifelong, in that people need to do modular pieces of education and then be updating what they've learned throughout life in order to keep pace with the advancements in work.
And I remember you perhaps suggesting that instead of federal aid for $20,000 degrees that perhaps don't always lead into jobs, that why not actually give some aid for some of the shorter form courses that perhaps edX and others are more famous for as well.
Exactly. I really believe we need to move to a modular system where people can get pieces of education. And so on edX, for example, we have a short program called the Micro Masters. It's about 25% of a master's degree, and people can collect a number of these as their careers change, and it costs about $1,000. A full master's degree may cost anywhere from $20,000 to $100,000 for MBAs. And instead, here, imagine getting something for $1,000. But today, students cannot use financial aid dollars from the government for these innovative new programs. And so, that tends to perpetuate a broken and inefficient system and doesn't allow innovation to come in. And certainly the audience seemed to really empathize with that view, that we need to be innovating even in policy levels.
Well, in fact, I'm speaking to one of the policy leads this afternoon from the Office of EdTech. So I suppose if you were, apart from the federal aid issue, if you were to have a wish list of policy levers that you could use to change the education landscape, what would you have on your wish list?
I think one of the biggest things that we have that is fairly antediluvian is our whole accreditation system, where there are accrediting bodies that accredit universities. And it's very challenging to have new entrants come into the field that are doing innovative things. And frankly, when I've talked to some of these accrediting bodies, they too are looking for innovative programs. So I think one of the big changes I would like to see happen is change the way we do accreditation, and perhaps create a new accrediting body that would focus on validating or accrediting newer innovative programs. We've heard of innovative boot camps that fill a need. We've heard of shorter programs, a number of innovative programs that I think can benefit from innovation.
Yeah, I interviewed previously a gentleman from the Skills Fund. I don't know if that's something that they were trying to solve, but accreditation is a, a big one. In fact, the gentleman that I just interviewed before we came into the room was a 21-year-old AI entrepreneur from Sweden, I believe. And I asked him what question he would ask of you, but also his experience was quite relevant to what you said on the panel yesterday, because he started doing the Andrew Ng course on AI whilst he was at school. And so, you know, he did his first year of university and thought, actually, I'm going to start, you know, continue and start my business. And so it was quite indicative of this idea of, you know, you don't have to kind of wait, you can learn as you go. But what he was interested in was, because he was doing the course fairly early on, you know, there were gaps on his in his knowledge, say, for example, around maths. So could the next iteration of online learning then kind of anticipate, okay, you're a younger learner, so you need that kind of additional resource around maths before you move on and kind of adapt in that way? I just wondered if that's something that's already been developed or...
I think that's a very important point in that learning is not something where you just go take a course. You have to. You may have to learn some maths background, or you may have to go and get some background in writing, or a number of other disciplines. And so there tend to be pathways. And one of the things that we've tried to do at edX to address that issue is we've begun to build out quite a few high school level courses as well, particularly in maths and language and science, and also many humanities disciplines, so that as people try to do some of the harder courses, they find, oh, you know what, I need prerequisites in maths. And then we offer those links on the same course and say, hey, look, if you need prerequisites in maths, you can go and take these programs. So, for instance, I teach a circuits course on edX, and that course needs prerequisites in calculus and complex algebra. So we have links in there, either embedding some of that material directly into the course or links to other courses, particularly at the high school level, where they can get that knowledge. So it's very important to create pathways like this that enable students to develop the appropriate background in order to learn more advanced material.
I put out a tweet on our feed to ask if anyone had any questions for you. And there's a lady from the University of Southampton who asked, if you did all this again, say you knew what you knew now when you were starting out, what would you do differently?
I think one of the things that we would certainly look to do very differently is think a lot more about what the what pathways might look like. So when we started out, we would pretty much put up any courses, sort of like a thousand flowers bloom idea. You know, hey, you want to do a course? Go do a course. And what ended up happening was you would get some duplication. You would not have the prerequisites. And so I think we learned this as we went along. And today we are much more proactive in working with our university and institutional partners in terms of creating appropriate courses at the right levels and with proper pathways, so that there is a pattern to the set of offerings. While in the past, when we started out, it was pretty much ad hoc. And so if we were to do something differently, maybe one of the things would have been to kind of plan out what a whole catalog might look like, and then be very proactive in working with partners to fill out specific items in that catalog, as opposed to having universities and institutions simply create whatever was interesting to them. Because oftentimes, some of those things may not have been interesting to students, or some things may have been interesting to students, but they may not have had the background to do it. And so being thoughtful about creating prerequisites courses before creating more advanced courses might have been a better approach.
Interesting. And I mean, some of the conversations I've had here have been around the cost of production and perhaps there being a bit of an arms race among the universities to increase the quality of production. How much does a kind of edX course cost to produce on average?
So the average course, if you're talking about a 4 to 8 week course, may cost on the order of $20,000 to $50,000 to produce, depending on what features you use and so on. However, I would actually like to challenge the question, which is, there have been studies that show, in fact, a study on edX that looked at a large number of videos and student engagement of those videos. And there's a paper written on it by a researcher who's now a professor at UC San Diego. And his paper presented that the quality of the video and the amount of money spent on the video was largely a second-order effect in student engagement and outcomes. What this showed was that the enthusiasm of the instructor was much more important. And in fact, in some cases, GarageBand style, home basement videos that were sort of hammered out very quickly with a very engaging instructor may have had much bigger impacts than extremely expensive, elaborately studio arranged videos that may have been over choreographed. So I just question the question that we need to be spending huge amounts of money in production. I think we need to be much more thoughtful about it.
Yeah. Another question. So I saw a recent report around, I suppose, the average user of an online course and whether perhaps they are, on average, they've already done a degree, they've already benefited from some form of formal education. And I guess, I really liked your comment yesterday about, education being a human right and why would we want to limit access to that? So I suppose the question is how do we make sure that with online learning, we don't just exacerbate the gap that already exists in terms of who's educated and perhaps who might lag behind as well.
I think it's very important for us to make sure that we increase access to education for everybody. The gaps are so big today that anything that we do will be helpful. It turns out that on edX, for example, the median age of the learner is about 26 or 27. For our MicroMasters programs, the median age of the learner is even higher, around 30 years, where people are upskilling themselves as many of them already have jobs, for example. At the same time, edX is working with foundations like the Lumina Foundation and so on, where part of our goal is to reach out to communities of learners that may be much more underserved than the traditional community of learners on MOOCs. And so we are trying various experiments in terms of partnering with community colleges, for example, that reach a particular demographic. We are partnering with schools, and we have a lot of high school content. Because oftentimes, if you have more advanced content, it's kind of game over at that time, because if you haven't learned the prerequisite material in high school, because you couldn't afford it or you didn't go to a good school. If you haven't learned advanced or basic computer science in high school, it's very hard for you to start off in college. So we launched a high school program. We launched nearly 100 courses at the high school and school level in basic computer science and math so that people could get those skills and then learn the more advanced material. But I'm sure we could do a lot more to reach populations of learners that need the education the most.
Okay, so thank you. I've got Dhaval Shah here as well from Class Central, so welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I was really excited to bring you along as well because I attended your Evolution of MOOCs presentation here at South by Southwest EDU, and I just thought it'd be a really interesting conversation between two experts in this field. In terms of what's happening. So I suppose, first of all, perhaps for the listeners, you could give us a little summary of especially the top 5 points, if you can recall them, that you summarized in your presentation as well.
Sure. So the first trend was shrinking of free. And generally, over time, across MOOC providers, there are certain free components that are no longer free. I think edX is still the most free and at least, except the certificate, everything else is free. But other providers have started putting paywalls in front of content. And the second trend was MOOCs no longer massive. And part of this reason is because of switch to a self-paced schedule. Before, MOOCs were session-based, and usually learners went through one or two sessions a year throughout the year. Now everybody's starting their own cohort or going through one of many cohorts at the same time, and this dilutes the community that goes through the same material at the same time. And that's why engagement and MOOCs have dropped across the providers. Sometimes when the course launches, there's high engagement. After a while, it dies down. Mm-hmm. Third one is based on credentialing. MOOC providers have like launched, have credit initiatives. They have their own micro-credentials. There are over 500 micro-credentials and online degrees. Some like edX have combined credit and micro-credentials into one thing called MicroMasters. Yeah, the fourth trend is MOOCs have found their audience, and the audience is professional learners, people who are well beyond their educating years and are probably working in industry, and they're either trying to get a better performance at the current job, learn new skills, or switch their careers. And the fifth one is a product at every price. And what I mean is like some like edX, when they just started, they were only free. Then they added a certificate. Then they added credit. Then they added credentials. And now they have online degrees. Mm-hmm. And they also have a enterprise offering. So you're now like have $0 to almost, depending on the enterprise deal, it can be go up to $1 million. So they have, they're able to do with the same content. It's usually the same content that's offered at different price points. And so I think it gives a way to for universities and the MOOC providers to monetize efficiently.
So I suppose an interesting question to both of you on I think it was the third one, in terms of corporate learning. If I was looking to future-proof my career for the next 5 years, what are the top three courses that you'd recommend? So that could be either be on edX or it could be on any platform.
Being a professor myself and having taught for 30 years, it's a very hard question because I think more learning is better. But if there's three topics that everybody should know that they don't know today, I would say one should be computer science. I think everybody should know about computational thinking. And so, for example, MIT's basic course on computer science and computational thinking might be a good example. It's a very basic course. High schoolers can do it and are doing it. And I think programming, in my mind, has become the fourth R, reading, writing, arithmetic, and programming. So I think that is one. Second thing is writing. It is very clear from data from a lot of employers and others that they're really looking for good communication and writing skills. In fact, the most sought after skill on resumes is actually good writing, and it's not other things that we might think about. And so, for example, Berkeley has a fantastic course on writing, for instance, that's hugely popular. So I would say writing. A third one, I would say, would be a combination of soft skills. Again, employers are looking for soft skills, and the Rochester Institute of Technology has a great professional certificate program on soft skills involving, you can actually teach critical thinking, you can teach teamwork. And so I would say these are the three that I would favor.
I'm going to go and sign up straight away.
I should have gone before, Anand. The only thing I would add, the first course I would do is learning how to learn. And I think it's just because it's a base course that will allow. Learning online is actually really difficult, even for the most motivated people. So starting with the course, learning how to learn, and then you can go on to these other courses so that your chances of failure are reduced. It's still high, but
okay. Well, thank you for the recommendations. And one of my questions was actually, people are a bit obsessed with coding, so I like the distinguishment between coding and computational thinking, because I think that's really important. But I put, what's the greatest thing that coding has done for you, or programming? Because obviously you've had an amazing experience, following learning that as well.
So I really want to make a distinction, like you did, between coding and computational thinking. I think computational thinking is the really important part. You know, it's like saying when you do mathematics, it's understanding numeracy and understanding the beauty of math versus, what coding is like, how do you use a calculator? But understanding math is computational thinking. What that has done for me is throughout my life is enabled me to think about how I can use computation as a way to have much bigger impact in whatever I do. So previously, if I could, let's say, for example, just as a simple, silly example, if I wanted to add six numbers, I could pull out my calculator and add six numbers manually. It would take me 6 seconds. But what I've begun to think now is, when I do something, how do I scale it to millions? And so now, you know, I might go and write a little program to add a million numbers. That could happen in the blink of an eye. If I want to do seven numbers, it works. If I'd want to do a million numbers, it works. And so I think it's enabled me to think about how I can leverage the power of technology, cloud computing, video distribution at scale, to do things at quality in the small, or to expand to massive scale. So computational thinking has really opened my eyes to, you know, the power of how technology can, you know, have massive, widespread change and impact, both in scale and quality.
And what's the most powerful teaching experience that you've had, whether that's, you know, within your universities or online as well? Are there any kind of interactions with students or follow-up stories from students that you've had where you thought, wow, that was, yeah, I'm really amazed that's kind of been the experience of that person afterwards?
You know, it's very interesting. There's just so many, you know, so many stories. I'll just give you one quick little example. This is like choosing between your children.
I mean, I know, you're not meant to have favorites.
There's so many stories, but let me pick one. But at MIT, last year we did a pilot where 40 students took a completely online circuits course even while they were on campus. 100% online, not blended, but a fully online course. And we expected all the students to be on campus. And towards the end, we asked them all to show up so we could just talk to them. And one student didn't show up. And his name was Ali Abdullah. And I inquired, so, you know, where was he? Turned out that he was actually doing an internship at a company in California, and he'd taken a semester off. And so he'd been able to use the online course as a way to catch up and do an online course, even while he did his internship, and got academic credit at MIT for doing so. And in fact, he also wrote to me saying that he was able to use what he was learning in the course at his internship, which was at Tesla.
All right, nice.
So, I mean, coding has given me my job. I started as a Class Central as a side project, built it over the weekend. And going back to the three things, like the three core types of courses Anand recommended, I had number one. I had the skills for number one, but over time I worked on number two and number three. And I think they might be even more important depending how you use it, especially in the business world. I think number two and number three can add a lot of value if you have like a decent level of knowledge of number one, like the coding course. Number two is writing and number three is soft skills.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear about the writing. Yeah, it's often overlooked, I think, certainly in contemporary discourse.
If I might add, you know, if there's one thing, if I were to redo my life, if there's one thing that I should have done and spend more time on growing up as a kid, is writing. Growing up in India, we spent a lot of time on technical skills and math and science and so on. And writing wasn't important at all. It's something you did. And the sooner you got it done, the better. But there's one thing I wished I'd done better and I could do better. I still struggle with writing. It's like pulling teeth for me right now.
Do you ever do creative writing? Do you enjoy writing?
I really enjoy writing. I used to write poems and so on.
Yeah.
But I find writing very hard even today. Luckily for me, I talked a lot in college. So I did a lot of debates and speeches and so on. So I think I'm okay in the talking department. But my writing is very slow and I struggle and I'm not confident. And I wish I had learned much better writing, learned to write much better. So I could be much more facile at it than I am today.
Very interesting. Last question. We always ask the guests on the EdTech podcast in terms of inspiration, so people that have had a big impact on the way you think, the work that you do, or just generally in your life. So either people that have inspired you or any books that you also go back to that you'd like to share with our listeners. So who'd like to go first?
I can go. I mean, I would go back to learning how to learn. Barbara Oakley, she has a book and she writes a lot. So I look at her writing and I saw how she has built a career around writing. She's also a professor, but I saw how she built a career around writing and gets published in big publications, and I try to mimic some of it. And obviously, I use what I learned in the course on a day-to-day basis.
And you have your colleague's book about no-cost MBA, or I can't remember
what
the title is.
Yeah, I get your MBA for cheap or something. Yeah. I can't remember the exact title, but I haven't read it yet. But I did contribute to some aspects of it in terms of courses. And
okay, cool.
I would say for me, particularly with the online, with edX and the career that I have today, I think my biggest inspiration was Sal Khan. You know, I think you can trace back the entire movement to Sal Khan. You know, the trajectory was MIT was doing open courseware, about 17, the early part of the century, and they were giving away courses for free. And then Sal Khan really took it to the next level and brought video and teaching and engagement. And to me, he was just a huge inspiration. And his course and his style, the tablet capture style, inspired me. And that's what inspired the formation of edX. And in fact, in the first course on edX, which my colleagues and I taught, was a course on circuits. And I used exactly his style. And in fact, I did not realize this, but at one point he told me that in one of my big classes, he was actually my student at MIT 20 years ago. Wow. And he was in one of the big classes, and I didn't even know that he was my student. And he told me, I've been your student. So to me, that was just amazing. And I've been hugely inspired by him. I did ask him once, I said, I do tablet capture videos just like you do. What advice do you have for me? And the advice he told me was that before you start hammering out your video on a tablet, just sit back and smile and really get chilled and relaxed, and then just let go. And it's okay if you make mistakes and so on, and just be natural. And I've followed that advice to the letter. And students have also liked the naturalness of the video. So easily, Sal Khan is my big inspiration.
It's fantastic how your lives have intertwined and gone back and forth like that. On the chilling out aspect, I was told, you know, when I'm recording the intro to the podcast, sometimes I just go like, la 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 la, like you have to, exactly. Yeah, just
otherwise you feel clicky,
yes,
and you feel kind of stifled.
Yeah,
yes.
You have to kind of get into it like
get
that. Okay, well, fantastic, thank you both so much for your time today. If people want to kind of follow up and find out what you're up to, I think you're at Class Central on Twitter.
Yes.
And at Agarwal, what's the Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at Agarwal, yes. Edu, AGARWALEDU.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
This week's episode. If you enjoy the EdTech podcast, please consider taking a look at our Patreon site and signing up for just $1 a month. I hope that you get more value than that from each listen, and if enough of you do it, it will be a wonderful thing. If that's not your cup of tea, but you love giving reviews, feel free to post a review on iTunes or Spotify, or share the podcast with an EdTech or Edu friend. That's all for now. We will be back soon with more from South by Southwest EDU and around the world. Bye-bye.